Roth Radio. David Lee Roth here, and I have a very special guest. His name is Stephen Woolley. He says he's the director and producer of a new movie chronicling the life of the Rolling Stones' Brian Jones called Stone, but I think it's a little bit more than that. Stephen, welcome.
Hi.
So how long did it take you putting together this picture?
Well, around about 12 years, but you know, I did make a lot of other movies during that time as a producer, so I was really basically working on this off and on between all my movies, and it was a struggle, you know, to get to the, what I believe is the truth.
And did you set off to direct this yourself?
No.
What happened?
No, I just kind of fell into the material. I just got closer and closer to it. And I found people the police couldn't find. I, you know, went to Stockholm to dig Brian's ex-girlfriend up. And it was a really kind of like hard, very sort of fascinating investigative journey. And by the end of it, the writers turned to me and said, "You have to direct this after 10 years of working on it."
In terms of the story, I can give a synopsis, but I'd rather hear your voice say it. And I have seen your picture. I watched it at home here.
Oh,
explain what it is that you're presenting here. What is this?
Well, I was fascinated. You know, I grew up in the 60s, really, as a kid. And you chose between the Stones and the Beatles. And it's very interesting listening to your Rock Hall of Fame stories tonight, this morning. And I kind of chose the Stones because they were the rebels and they were the anarchists and they were the ones who were going to lead the revolution. But really, I discovered later on, I made a film called Backbeat about the Beatles in Hamburg, and I realized that whilst John Lennon and Paul McCartney were playing strip clubs and hanging out with existentialists in Germany, you know, Mick Jagger was at London School of Economics. We were sold a different idea of who these people were. And so I kind of saw the Stones in 76, and again, listening to one of your callers talking about the Pistols, you know, I saw the Sex Pistols, I think, 6 or 7 times in that summer of punk, you know. And I realized, well, I thought even then the Rolling Stones were a little tame. They weren't really. That wasn't Joe Strummer. That wasn't Johnny Rotten.
I agree with you.
They were kind of going off the boil in the 70s. And so later on, when I read these books about the murder of Brian Jones, I thought, well, the thing was murder. He was murdered. That was extraordinary. How could they claim he was murdered? But also, it was Brian who was the one. He was the kind of more anarchic, more rebellious spirit, the Rolling Stones. He's the one who discovered the music of Robert Johnson and Muddy Waters and Elmore James and wanted the band to play that. He was the one that really pushed the Stones into a different level aesthetically. The way he dressed, the way he thought, the way he was a pretty interesting character.
Interesting, because we always think of Mick as being the hood ornament for that vehicle, but what you're saying is no, that was Brian Jones, who was really the face of that band.
He was the icon, the 60s icon. He was up there with Jimi Hendrix, with Janis Joplin, with all of those guys. They were his friends. Bob Dylan was Brian's friend, you know. To begin with, Mick and Keith were very shy. I mean, I know it's hard to believe, you can't, you know, now that Mick Jagger could be described as shy, but in the early 60s, he was. And it was Brian's push. He's the one who pushed the band into, you know, Bill Wyman always says, no Jones, no Stones. And that was the reality. So I wanted to tell that story as well as the story of his murder. I thought, let's try and recover Brian. Let's show kids now who Brian Jones was.
There's a tremendous amount of mystery. And if mystery is just absence of information, he's the one that has the most absence of information.
Yeah.
What was the story? What was the background, etc.?
Well, for me, it was, you know, the story of Brian being stuck in this house, being adrift from the other Stones, really having wasted, you know, a good deal of his life, taking too many drugs.
What drugs was he taking?
Well, I mean, I think acid became very, very popular then. And he was taking a lot of uppers, a lot of downers, a lot of coke. But I think acid was the thing that Brian really loved. And he couldn't take it. I mean, he really just shouldn't have taken the amount, the quantities of drugs he took. And then I think he wanted to get off the drugs. So when he died, he actually was pretty drug-free. But he lived in his house on his own, away from the other Rolling Stones. Eventually, they fired him.
Did they fire him because of his drug use, because of his unavailability, or was there a polarization before that?
There was a musical polarization. Brian really was scoring soundtracks. Brian was recording musicians in Morocco, Djibouti musicians. He was the first person to do that. He did a score with Volker Schlondorf, who later went on to the Tin Drum, which he won an Oscar for. Brian was a Renaissance man. He didn't see himself as a touring rock and roll band member, which the others saw themselves very much as. You know, they wanted to crack America. Brian wasn't so interested in that. He saw himself as an artist. But ironically, Brian didn't write any of the songs. It was Mick and Keith.
This is interesting as you describe the characters and fill in some of the gaps in history. I'm 51, growing up in the 60s, very aware of the bands. I myself was a Rolling Stones guy. And as you describe it, is that, you know, Mick, coming from an academic background, was very business, and Brian was truly an artist. Hey.
Yeah, no, very much so. And I think that was what fascinated me about this story is that, you know, we think about Jim Morrison, we think about Janis, we think about Jimmy, all of whom died at age 27, just at the same time as Brian, a few months later. Within a year, I think, of Brian Jones's death, they'd also all died. And yet they were all close friends, and they were pushing the limits. And I really think in the 60s, people just didn't know what the drugs would do.
So you're really blaming it on the drug use then?
I think it's partly that, and it's also the cruelty of that time. I think Keith Richards always said we could take no passengers. You know that he felt guilty. I think in the early 70s about Brian's death, and I think the music business was very cruel, much crueler than it is now.
Oh, how many records did you put out a year in 1962? How many, you know, you'd have to put out 2 and 3 albums in a given season. You would have to write it in the back of the train like on Hard Day's Night. That's a cartoon of the way the life really was.
And who could have imagined in 1962 that in 44 years later, the Rolling Stones would have their biggest tour ever? No one imagined that. For the record industry, it was, you know, chew them up, spit them out, chew them up, spit them out. There was no longevity. No longevity imagined for these pop stars. You know, they were flimsy. They were, you know, kind of effeminate nothings. The record industry was just, you know, really cruel.
Were there any management that stood out at that point in time who saw it differently, who perceived a longevity was available? Did the Stones management at any time ever perceive of that?
Well, there's a guy who lives here in New York called Alan Klein, you know,
sure.
Abco Records, who was clever and smart enough to really, really take the whole Rolling Stones, Beatles things into his own hands. And in fact, Alan Klein owns everything that the Rolling Stones recorded or published.
I was going to say, he's so clever that he owns the mortgages on a lot of tunes there.
He does, yeah.
Explain that to the public in your voice, if you would.
Well, Alan Klein really took over the Beatles and the Stones management at a time when the record companies were really, really giving them a bad deal. And Klein proved that there was millions to be made for the artists. So in many respects, Alan Klein was a good guy because he gave the money to the Beatles and the Stones and said, look, here it is. He renegotiated deals. He was tough. He was a hard New Yorker that these grothers, kind of, you know, shallow English guys kind of needed a big guy to go in there with a baseball bat. Ironically, they then realized that there was more money to be made than they were getting. So it was a case of giving somebody what they didn't know they had, but then they realized there was a hell of a lot more that they could have. So Alan sort of became the bad guy in the 70s for a lot of these bands. But he was a very, very smart, very clever guy, and he was the kind of guy that wasn't around there batting for those bands. And people like Brian Jones, you know, as you see in the movie in Stoned, you know, he was the kind of guy that had none of that help. Nobody, no advisors. When he died, the night of his death, which was this very hot, sunny night, very, very sort of real English kind of, you know, late, you know, sort of 11 o'clock at night, he just had no one around him. No PR, no chefs, no management, nothing. There was him, a builder, a nurse, and, you know, a girlfriend, and that was it. You know,
he was disenfranchised at that point in time. Do you think this is an individual who counted on that disenfranchisement for his inspiration? If he had been part of the gang and not ostracized, if he had been part of on the train, so to speak, would he have been as productive musically?
I don't think there was a train for Brian, and I think it was the same for Jimmy. I think it was the same for Jim Morris. I think it was the same for Janis. I think they were lost souls. I think that a combination really wasn't just the drugs, and I think it's not a moral film in that sense, because I think you see in the movie that there's a lot of fun to be had, you know, with Anita Pallenberg, who's played by Monique Mazur. You know, you see that her and Brian had a great time in the 60s. It wasn't just the drugs. I think it was really kind of the lack of acceptance that this kind of music, it was truly art. And I think we now look back at Hendrix and we listen to that stuff and we go, man, that's fantastic. You know, we think of him as the way we think of John Coltrane. at that time, I don't think people thought that way at all.
No, not at all. We thought of them as the alternative, you know, that it was a divisive thing in our culture. Even the Beatles' haircuts. When Mick Jagger wore a sweatshirt on Ed Sullivan, that was heresy.
Yeah. Well,
that's part of what attracted us here, you know.
No, absolutely. We grew up, you know, we grew up in a time, because I was a child then, but, you know, we were going to inherit that world. That's what we all wanted. We wanted the girls, the long hair, the fame. We wanted to be in the world of Brian Jones. But the reality was, around me growing up in Islington in North London, most of my uncles had fought in the Second World War. They were shirt and tie, and they hated this music. The generation gap has never been wider than it was in the 60s. I mean, they were angry. My cousins, who were older than me, they had long hair and short skirts. They'd get whacked around. I mean, the generation gap was huge during that time. And I wanted to show that part of the 60s as well in the movie.
Something that you showed wonderfully in this picture is, quote-unquote, how it looked in the 60s. Okay, my first time touring through England was right around mid-late 70s, so there was a lot of the telephones, the ashtrays, the way the clock on the wall looked, the recording gear, the microphones in some of the BBC studios and whatnot. This is going to be probably the only real link with that part of the 60s in the UK that a lot of young people like Sash here will ever actually have contact with, and you hit it so accurately. How long does it take you to put together something like this?
Well, you know, I not only did I kind of love the music of the 60s, I love the movies of the 60s. So I shot this film using 8mm, 16mm, old cameras, reversal stock. And I looked at films like Performance and The Servant, which are kind of 60s classic movies. And even a film like The Ipcress File. And I shot the film in low angles. I shot it through reflections. I tried every time we flash back to a different era to show a different side of the 60s. So when you go to Morocco, for instance, the skies are very, very blue and there's a very ochre sense. So in terms of the colour scheme for the film and in terms of the way I shot it, I really relied very much on 60s movies. So there are points in the film. I mean, the biggest flattery that I've had is people saying, I thought you shot it in the 60s. You know, you walk in halfway through the movie and you think you're watching a 60s film. I hope. That's what I tried to create. So I really wanted to go back with the costumes and with, obviously, the art, all the art direction to create another time. And I think we just about got enough still going around. You know, we just got enough reference. I mean, the 60s was probably the most photographic era ever, you know.
Well, and people were moving into the pop art. Popular art impacted everything, right down to the telephone and the way the ashtray looked. It probably, arguably, the first era before that was the Roaring Twenties. Deco informed everything. But when pop art kicked in, who got it better than the Brits? And that was there was much more media in terms of what was happening in the UK than in the United States. In the 60s, we only had Tiger Beat and one or two other little magazines. And in the UK, you had Melody Maker, it Sounds, and a whole variety that really, you know, caught a trend and made it much more popular much more quickly. Agree or disagree?
Yeah, I kind of agree. There was the New York thing going on in the 60s. There was Warhol and all that stuff, which was pretty extraordinary. And I think that was a little pocket. I think there were little pockets around, you know, you look at Haight Ashbury, you look at San Francisco. I mean, Brian loved the whole San Francisco scene, which was pretty amazing. The whole Jefferson Airplane, you know, which later became the Grateful Dead, that scene in San Francisco, which kicked off really in the 50s with literature, with the beat poets and the beat writers, you know, Kerouac, etc. So there were little pockets around America. And I think in Britain it was similar. I think in London, in Liverpool, in Manchester, there were little pockets of little revolts. And then it kind of really mushroomed in the 70s when you guys started. But the 60s, really, a lot of people had to pay the price for the 60s. And I think Brian was one of those guys who paid the price for being way out there, for being so extreme.
The only thing that we saw from the 60s was 16mm film that had been shot somewhere, either in New York or San Francisco, 2 days ago, because it had to be developed and then censored, then put on the Channel 5 news, all right, and then it was gone. The only time that you really got the culture was with the album cover, watching a concert, listening to the album, delving into the interviews, etc. This is how the culture was imported to us. How long did it take you to cast this? Was this a quick effort, or was this an inexorable march?
Well, it took me 12 years to research it and to find the people I had to find. And during that period, I looked at various actors to play Brian Jones. Eventually, I came up with this guy, Leo Gregory, who was very, very good in the film, who was an unknown actor. I couldn't cast a name as Brian Jones because I think he would have kept thinking, oh my God, it's Jude Law in a wig, or oh my God, it's Ewan McGregor with strange sideburns. So I had to have somebody who, A, was a very good actor, which Leo is, and B, would be the face of Brian Jones for anyone watching the movie.
He was frighteningly close.
Well, Anna Wolin, who was Brian's last girlfriend, cried her eyes out when she saw the film. She just said, oh my God, that is Brian. She was really... She didn't think it was her. She thought the actress playing her was too beautiful, but she thought Brian was Brian.
Yeah, that's a self-esteem issue. Yeah. They were popular in the 60s. What about the fellas in the Stones today? Are they familiar with your work? Have you had any contact with them?
I've met Mick many, many times. You know, he has his foray into film producing. And, you know, as a producer, you know, I've made films like The Crying Game and Interview the Vampire and Michael Collins. And, you know, I've produced quite a lot of pretty successful films, which have, you know, done well. So I've kind of come across Mick. They're very reserved about this film. There is no reason that the Rolling Stones would want Brian Jones's, you know, memory to be reawakened. If you think about it, Brian Jones was only in the band for 7 years, and they've been touring for 44.
Okay.
He was the catalyst for the band. Without him, I don't think the band would have existed. But we think of Mick and Keith as the icons now, not Brian Jones. So they're keeping a very sort of stately reserve on the movie.
Okay, well, this is a band, nobody says the Rolling Stones, a great 60s band. They've always managed to kind of...
They've reinvented themselves through the eras, and it's astonishing. You look at the tour now, precisely why Brian couldn't live with these guys is because they are incredible. The work they put into those tours, it's amazing. I mean, they're working harder now than they've ever worked. And how old are they? I mean... Older than you and I.
Fascinating. Stephen Woolley, he's the director of Stoned, and this opens up on the 24th, I believe?
It does, yes.
Okay, and is this national? Are you opening national?
We start with New York and L.A. and San Francisco, and then we roll out the rest of America.
Highly recommend it. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you, David.
David Lee Roth in the mornings on 92.3 Free FM.
David Lee Roth， 一个高速度的电台。David Lee Roth， High Speed Radio， Radio Roth。
Wash you out of my eyes. Too many bad times of loving you. Now I gotta realize that I can throw you right out of my mind and put you right back in your place. 'Cause lightning never strikes twice in the same place. I can live without loving you, carry on in the same old way. Do anything that I want to do, say what I want to say. 'Cause I can throw you right out of my mind and put you right back in your place. 'Cause lightning never strikes twice in the same place.
Roth Radio. Just had Stephen Woolley on the phone. He was good, but talking about Brian Jones. Take it home, B. Young. He was a great guest, huh? All the stuff that you never knew. You got to see this movie. You got to go in. You got to go see Stoned. And that's coming up on the 24th. He's a producer and the director of it. Amazing picture. If you've never had familiarity with what's going on behind the scenes, especially in the 60s, you want to see all the clothes and the lighting. And like he was talking about, he was using film media, the black and white and the way it looked on the television, the sound variations that he used. Obviously, he spent years putting an effort into this. This is going to be a big show for him here. Are you a Rolling Stones fan, Sash?
Yes, I am.
Are you familiar with the earlier stages of the band?
I know of, okay. But I'm not, like, super familiar. This would be a good movie for me.
Because if you knew Brian Jones, then that would be your hero. The fellas today are spectacular, but he was so left of center.
Yeah.
He was disenfranchised. Somebody cut his anchor chain and he was drifting free. That's perfect art. Like Uncle Manny said in the first interview, he's not afraid to go deep. Brian Jones, stoned. Check it out. Coming up also, Jeffrey Slonim from Gotham Magazine. He's actually going to be calling in here. All the gossip in the news that's fit to print, huh? You know, they handed me a whole list of good things here about Paris Hilton. She's got a CD coming in June. Jeff will know about this. Did you know she did a version of Do You Think I'm Sexy?
By Rester, yeah.
Have you seen it? Have you heard it? Is
no.
it out?
No. I heard that it was... that she was doing it, but I don't think it's out.
Okay, well, you know, again, like we said, you don't necessarily have to have a singer's voice. You know, maybe she's going to do it Girl from Ipanema style. That was, you know, Do You Think I'm Sexy? That would be sufficient for me. Oh, I went. Go ahead, man. Play it out there. Anyways, Jeff Slonim from Gotham Magazine. He's going to be calling in about 10, 15 minutes. And these are all the questions that they've lined up. I guess this is what America wants. Was Jessica Simpson really dumped by Maroon 5's Adam Levine by text message? You know whose love life I'm curious about? Is Shaun White, who's been in your guitar student, because you know he's going rock star. You totally know he's on the bus, right?
There's
going
to be no love there. It's just all fun.
It's a total fun. Are you kidding? How old a kid is he? He's like 19 going on 30, right? And there he is in every picture with every hot babe.
He's 19 going on 16. He's awesome.
There goes his career. We'll be watching his movie in about 10 years.
Brian, didn't you say you saw him squeezing Pam Anderson?
Well, he sent me a picture. I think it's out in the magazines now.
Yeah.
He's squeezing her?
No, they were partying together. They had his big party in L.A.
Get out of here. It all starts that way. Was she squeezing him or was he squeezing her?
They were like dancing.
And the cradle will rock. Who has Nick Lachey been linked with? We don't know. Lindsay Lohan says she would do a nude scene if she knew she'd win an Oscar for it. What are you laughing at? Can you imagine her little nakedness? Does she even have private parts? Has she grown some yet? I know she grew some. Are they in operating order? Are they open for business? I mean, you know, judging from Shaun White's referendum, her genitals must be open for business. I don't know if he was... if he was ushered into the inner sanctum, but a fella could get lucky, huh? Wear that gold medal like a belt buckle, huh? And pull up to the bumper. Lindsay, get over here, cowgirl. We're going to want to find out what's up with celebrities beating their wives and the girlfriends. You remember when we did the contest, you know? Who knows the best song to beat your wife to? Smack My Bitch Up, parts 1 through 14. And then Yanni was arrested for slapping his girlfriend. Wasn't that good when I said, hey, we're broadcasting to West Palm Beach. Which one of you guys are in blue uniforms down there? And the corrections officer called in.
Said he was crying.
He was probably. Are you kidding? Yanni in lockdown? That's got to be a horror show. Are you kidding? Animal, what would happen to Yanni if you were in a cell with him?
He'd be a girlfriend, of course, man.
I think he probably showed up terrified. Can you imagine? How do these guys get off punching their old lady, man? Do you think did they even think for a second that they would walk away from that? It's just not possible. Hasselhoff, same thing. Arrested for allegedly beating his wife. Man, how does somebody allegedly beat his wife? If there's a mark, they take a picture. They put your gloves on. You know what it's called in Spanish? Same word for wife. Your esposa. And when you have handcuffs, las esposas. Interesting, huh? Is Britney Spears pregnant again, or is she just getting fat? Probably both. A delicate house blend. Huh? What is she thinking? She's got a showbiz career. How old is Britney Spears at this point in time? What is she doing starting this kind of family here? You know what she's either going to do? She's either going to retreat from showbiz and become an on-duty mom, because two little kids like this demand virtually all your time, all of your calories, right? They've got to. Or she's going to start to invoke this thing of, well, it takes a village to raise a kid, you know, that Navajo stuff. And then she's going to pawn the kids off on the dog walker. No, really. She just graduated from a Chihuahua to a child. She probably can't even spell Chihuahua yet. And now she's going to hand that kid off to the nanny, the dog walker, the diaper man, you follow, etc., etc. Next, you're going to see the kid with a mohawk. And then you're going to see his own drug movie. I'm jumping ahead here. Or is that Angelina Jolie's kids?
Angelina.
God, I'm getting myself in trouble here. Roth Radio, broadcasting from New York to Philly, Dallas, Boston, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, West Palm Beach, worldwide. We're going through the list of questions I'm going to ask Jeff Slonim from Gotham Magazine. Sesame Street rejected the idea of having Russell Crowe on, saying he's not a good role model for kids. After the telephone incident, probably, right? Did he get off on that, or did he actually pay a huge down payment or something?
I think he kind of walked and dropped a few bucks on the table. That was about it.
Yeah, but how much is a few bucks for Russell Crowe? $100,000? He threw a phone at a guy behind a counter at a hotel. That's a $100,000 toss. Depending on who your attorney is. Seriously. All that guy's got to do is, again, show a little mark, just a little red mark or something. Take a picture. Las esposas. Okay. Sharon Stone gets naked in Basic Instinct 2. Do you think the Basic Instinct 1, that was an accident? You know, when she switches her legs and you can see the Bermuda Triangle for one frame or whatever that is. It was pretty well lit to me. There's no coincidences on a film set when you're shooting 35 millimeter union scale in a soundstage. Nothing just happens. Nothing's an accident. Nothing is, God, we never figured that might happen. Okay? You can't touch anything without seven union fellas doing it for you. If you saw that little Bermuda Triangle so perfectly, I can tell you that they took at least 2.5 hours to light it, do makeup. What was that, hair or makeup? Either way, it's union, man. You got that's a trip to two more trailers. I mean, hair is a whole different trailer. Makeup is a whole different trailer. Lighting, gaffers, they mic it up for sound. You never know. There may be some improvisation that takes place. You don't want to lose it, you know, because it's one of those things where, you know, she's going to balk, you know, at doing it a multiple of times. But, hey, take one for the regiment, huh? Hot stuff. And now she's in number two, Basic Instinct 2, and she's 47 years old. Will we be able to compare? Will there be a suitable scene that reflects on this?
I'm sure.
Do you think there's been some genital aging? Do you light that differently? Do you need more makeup for that? These are all questions that we look forward to answering with Jeffrey Slonim from Gotham Magazine. Madonna's daughter recently saw the kiss between her mom and Britney Spears, and now she's asking if mommy is gay. Is this kid going to be screwed up? More importantly, is mommy gay?
Man, you saw Bedtime Stories, didn't you?
What's Bedtime Stories?
Oh, that was a special she had on MTV in the bed, reading stories with girls laying all around and stuff. It's like early 90s, I think.
But was this for the children? She wrote a children's novel. It seems like everybody's got to do that at some point in their life.
This was for us grown-up children when she was in the bed, all in a negligee, girls all around. But they said it was a lot of good activity behind the scene on that.
For what was the name of it? What was she reading?
It's called Bedtime Stories.
I don't know what that is. I know that Madonna wrote a child's novel or something. And you're saying that this was not it.
It wasn't the one you talking about, believe that.
No, this sounds like something else. I don't know. Madonna's always been playing that card. You follow? When in doubt, kiss a girl. Have a girl kiss a girl. Our culture just erupts with that. You'd think we'd be familiar with it at this point in time. She keeps playing that card. She keeps winning with it. I'm going to wear a Kabbalah string if this keeps up here. Does Jessica Alba have a legitimate complaint against Playboy? What was her complaint? They put her picture on the cover of Playboy. And I think it was an old picture, and somehow it suggested that there was sexual content or something inside. And I don't even think that there were more articles or more photographs of her inside. Is that the case?
No, yeah. It's usually when the girl on the front of Playboy is the one that you're going to see in the centerfold naked. And she was suggesting that because she was on the cover, everybody that bought the magazine figured that she was going to be inside naked. That was the
okay, difference. Well, that's a legitimate issue. Did she take the picture for Playboy? Did she go to a Playboy magazine photo shoot in an effort to create something for the cover? Because they only do specific stuff. Playboy magazine doesn't pick pictures from somebody else. They hire their own superstar photographers. Again, there's no mistakes there. There's no coincidences. There's no coinky dings, because every time somebody steps into a photo session for that front cover, that's $150,000 crisp. That's before catering. That's before limos. That's before airplanes and managers, hotel rooms and agent hotel rooms. What are you pointing at, Sasha?
It says here the picture was for a movie promo.
It was for a movie promo.
It wasn't actually for
She was voted by the readers as like number one hottie or something like that. And they decided to use a stock photo.
Oh, somebody went cheap then, because that's way out of character. Okay, she's got a complaint. She should have said, you want me on the front of your magazine? Help me sell your magazine? Let's do a big expensive photo session. Good girl.
David Lee Roth in the mornings. 92.3 Free FM.
Du hører på David Lee Roth. Roth Radio på begynnelsen av morgenen. Sjokkerende stødig. You are listening to David Lee Roth. Roth Radio, first thing in the morning. Shockingly consistent.
Roth Radio, David Lee Roth, New York, Philly, Dallas, Boston, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, West Palm Beach. On the phone, I promised you, his name's Jeffrey Slonim. He's calling, he works Gotham Magazine. He writes the In and Out column for Gotham, and he just spent 10 days in Hollywood for the Oscars. He was a style and society writer for various publications. Jeffrey, it's David Lee. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, did you wake up or stay up for this?
I got up. It wasn't easy. I was out at the premiere last night.
Jeffrey, share with us, what did you experience in Hollywood with the Oscars? I understand you have a story about Pam Anderson and her fur, no pun intended.
Well, I did go to lunch up at the Flaunt House, and it was for this designer called, they do Sly, and the designer herself was wearing fur before. Pam was 2 hours late to the lunch, you know, you can expect that. But there's two chicks wearing fur at her table. And the head of PETA was there, and he was like, you have got to get these furs out of here. So the girl who was taking the furs off the girls, just to put them in the closet, they didn't care if they were actually there, rubs them up and down the PETA guy, who was just like, you got to get them out of here, Pam's gonna freak. And then they had a very nice lunch.
Oh, my God. What kind of furs were they? Are these like minks or something? Expensive?
They were, you know, exotic. They look scary. They look like you'd have trouble getting them over the border.
My question is Pam Anderson wear regular shoes, or does she wear vegan shoes as well?
That's interesting, because she wears a lot of makeup, and I would say she's pretty cautious about that. You're probably right, though. There's got to be some leather there.
Of course. What's holding her pants up? Come on. You know, whether it's the belt that's holding her pants up or the soles on her shoes, you really have to be have great convictions to completely avoid any kind of animal contact here.
Well, plus they need the heels. All those stars are like 2 feet tall, so they got to have 6-inch heels.
And there goes the trees. So much for conservation, huh?
It's true.
What about Paris Hilton? She has a CD coming out in June. I've heard a song or two, but I have not heard the Rod Stewart Do You Think I'm Sexy. Jeffrey, have you heard this tune?
I have not heard the tune. She did a little thing where she brought it to the Beverly Hills Hotel, and she forgot the CD in the car when she was debuting it.
No, wait, that's perfect.
But she went back and got it. She's a character. Paris is a character.
This jumps to mind the Menudo conflagration when the guys, you know, would travel around just limp singing. Here, there you go. Yeah. There's a Freudian slip. Limp syncing. And one day they forgot the record.
Well, it happened. Yeah, that's a problem when you don't have talent.
You just made an editorial there. Do you think that she has no talent, or do you think she has a chance with this?
You know, she's got Fat Joe helping her out on one of the songs. So, you know, she's worked with some great people. I haven't heard it yet, so I can't say. But I hear that it's not as bad as you'd think.
Okay, well, I'm gonna guess that it's pretty decent, because with today's recording techniques, you could pretty much tape record a plant in a pot and get something out of it. I could tape record a Dalmatian and actually get it to sit into the track correctly here. Who else is on her record? Do you have any idea?
She's working with the same producer she's been hanging out with. She's really worked it. I mean, she's hanging around with some very strange people to make this happen. I don't have the names here, but...
Do you think they've glommed on to her, or that she actually has some passion for this?
I mean, Paris is amazing, because you see her with just these, like, the sleaziest people you've ever seen, just so she can get this club started, or just so she can get this $1 million thing. Considering she's supposed to inherit $50 million, Rick's dad, I don't know if you've met them, they're very nice, the parents, but I was shocked when I learned that the father was worth $1 billion.
Ouch. And how much of that goes to Paris Hilton?
About $50 million. There must be tons of grandchildren or something.
Ouch.
So, you know, the fact that she's earning $6 million a year, she's working it. I mean, you've got to be impressed. She's thick thin, and she's running around doing all these projects.
What about Jada Kiss and Fat Joe? Aren't they involved in this?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, well, then this is a celebrity pile-up. It'll be interesting to see if we can even identify her voice when this is all over here. Is she making a video for this, you think? She's got to, right?
I mean, that's the selling point, right?
Oh.
She's got to take off the clothes a little bit.
I would certainly hope so. What about
In-N-Out Burger.
What about Jessica Simpson? Is she now in the market? What's going on with Maroon 5 here?
Well, we hear that he called it a hookup. And supposedly she just got a text message ending it. So I have a feeling she was looking for a little more than he was, perchance.
Okay. And is she aligned with anybody else, or is she back at the homestead already?
I think it just happened, so I think she's still out there. They're all out there. I was at a party after the Oscars, 4 a.m. up in the hills, and Nick Lachey was up there hanging with the dudes. And I think they're on the prowl.
Okay, do you think they're getting back together, though? Because this is on the front cover of all the all the favorite magazines where I buy liquor.
Well, I think that the only way to you know, keep their careers going is to mix it up like that.
I would think so. I don't know that Jessica even has it.
Wear the ring, get together, hook up. You got to keep it going.
There's a little Sonny and Cher going on there. Which one's the most responsible for the gross income there? Is it Jessica making the money, or is it Nick?
I mean, I haven't seen anything major that Nick's done lately.
No. What band was he even involved with? 98 Degrees? That was his one real claim to fame. How does he keep winding up with these gorgeous dolls?
You know, he's a good-looking guy, and he hangs out on the scene in L.A. He gets around. Once you got one star, I think you're on the circuit.
Is Jessica's father the true star of this confab?
He's a character. The parents are always working it in all these situations. I met Lindsay Lohan's mom the other day, and she was fabulous. I like her better than Lindsay.
I like her dad's story, the backstory on dad. The subtext there is a whole mini-series in and of itself. Is he still incarcerated?
He's had a lot of problems. They avoid that one, but, you know, he hit a telephone pole, or the guys had just problems up the wazoo. But, you know, these poor kids, they start out and then the parents fall apart.
I wonder if dad fell apart before the kid really happened, and that's why the kid went on to go into showbiz.
Well, I think it does drive them. You know, somebody's got to bring home the bacon if dad can't.
Seems like if there's a functional background and everybody's getting along, there's no good showbiz. No good music ever comes out of that. You got to have a dysfunctional family. There's got to be some convictions, either religious or prior. Agree or disagree?
I agree. I think that, you know, if you grow up like the Bradys, it's not happening.
No.
The world doesn't come out.
No, there's got to be some fight there. There's got to be some conflict, some sparks or whatever. What's up with the sparks that are going with David Hasselhoff and Yanni? Smack my bitch up, parts 1 through 12, huh?
Well, they've both been accused. They've both been accused.
Oh, of course they did it.
Nello in New York, but Nella Balan was also accused of beating his girlfriend, so it seems to be in the air, unfortunately.
He seems to be in their glass after happy hour, huh?
It's true.
And where is Yanni's career today? Where does that currently reside? Is he still selling millions of records? Or everybody knows who he is.
Well, he's not selling them to me, but Linda Evans may still be buying them.
Because in my estimation, he's right up there with Fabio.
It's true, except Fabio may not even be able to play an instrument.
And what about David Hasselhoff?
Fabio himself is his own instrument.
Are you a David Hasselhoff fan?
I am a huge David Hasselhoff fan. Baywatch was one of the the crowning achievements of this culture.
I'm speaking to Jeffrey Sloan. I'm the In and Out columnist going for the Gotham magazine. Where was David busted? Where did he get arrested?
I'm looking at it right here. David Hasselhoff, you know, she's accused him. I guess he was arrested the next day. Let's see.
Of course. If there's a little red mark, you take a picture and you put the handcuffs on. It's that instant. And we called the fellas down at West Palm Beach. You know, we have a huge audience of uniforms, I call it. Police, fire, paramedic, et cetera, et cetera. And we got in touch with one of the correction officers down at West Palm Beach. And he said that Yanni had a very, very terrible visit, that he was unaccepted by the remainder of those in lockdown, and that they taunted him and that he broke down into tears.
That's pretty scary. Well, I hope he didn't try to do some music. That might have caused all that.
Maybe redemption can be found in a next album here, the wife-beating album.
Oh, yeah, you got to get that out there. And imagine the dysfunction of their kids.
Who's Britney Spears is pregnant again. Who's the dad?
Well, we hear it's Kevin Federline, who's just such a wonderful father. He disappears every time. After the minute he has sex, he disappears.
Too hip, gotta go. Have you heard his album, Povo Jao? Are you familiar with that?
I have not heard his album. Have you heard it?
Yeah, I've heard a few of the cuts, and it's again like what I'm going to expect that Paris Hilton comes up with, is that you hire all of the other faces, you know, the Neptunes and whoever, the people who are actually making the music, and it's what I call freeze-dried vocals. It could pretty much be anybody. You'll have to wait to see the video, determine if his girls are better than anybody else's, and that's how we'll judge.
But we got to see who he hooks up with next, because you know, the guy's on the circuit, too.
How long do you think before they get a divorce?
About 10 minutes.
And what is she thinking? How old is this girl? 25 years old, something like this? 26 years old?
She's young enough to think that Kevin Federline would have been a good father after he dumped the first one. It's scary that these kids are making their own decisions because they're so young.
Yeah, and isn't this one of her backup dancers? Is that what he was doing for a living?
Dancer, for sure. They always meet them in the wrong places.
Ouch. And how long is she going to be able to continue having two little kids and pursue a career? You think a girl can do that at her age?
Well, she certainly can afford some help. What she needs is a nanny, not a husband.
A village to raise the kids. She's going to hire the dog walker and everything else to take care of these little kids.
Well, her mom helps, too. I think the real problem is that the mom doesn't get along with Kevin.
Ah, well, justifiably so. I would imagine that this is a marriage made in hell. Like you said, 10 minutes before homeboy wanders off, terrier style. Hey, the gate is open. Love you, too hip. Gotta go.
Well, she was buying him, you know, fancy sports cars and you know, you could tell it was all about all the wrong things from the start. From the wedding, Jesus, it was just like a crazy thing.
And what is this kid thinking in terms of her own personal energies and her own little figure and her own little personal disciplines when she's talking about doing movies, going to Broadway, traveling, et cetera, et cetera? These little kids aren't like little chihuahuas, or are they?
You know, they seem to be able to move around with kids, these stars. You know, they whatever kind of jet they're traveling on, but they... You know, there's a lot of movie stars that have kids that seem to bring them around to the set, and I'm sure it's not a great way to grow up, but until they have to be in school, I think she could do some things, possibly.
Shades of Gypsy Rose Lee. I'm talking to Jeffrey Sloanum. He's writing for the Gotham magazine. Let me ask you a couple more. Sharon Stone gets naked in Basic Instinct 2. Was it an accident in Basic Instinct 1?
Well, you know, the box office certainly wasn't an accident. I think they may have told Sharon it was an accident, but they may have grabbed the underwear the day of the shoot.
Yeah, because I gotta wonder, you know, we've both been on sound stages when they're shooting 35mm format under union rules. There's very few coincidences, very few mistakes. How did they get that lit so well? How did they manage to move the camera pan so quickly here? By the way, when you take a shot like that, do you call for hair or makeup?
Both, I think. Yeah, definitely. I want to be the makeup artist. That's the job I'm looking for.
And when mommy says her little girl, when the little girl says to mommy, "Mommy, are you gay?" What does mommy say?
Well, in Madonna's case, she says that, you know, the child is just obsessed. Lourdes is just obsessed with whether Madonna, you know, who's gay, who's not gay. And apparently, I mean, I don't think Madonna is gay. She's always been doing guys for years.
I agree with you.
Apparently, she used to pick them up in her limousine off the street in the East Village.
hey, those are rumors, and nothing's been ever demonstrated in a court of law with me present.
That's true. I take it back. I recant. I love Madonna.
I do, too. And what would be her answer be to a little girl like this? What does mommy say? Because mommy's on national television making out with some pretty hot babes.
It's true. Well, I think, you know, Lourdes has been around a lot in her young life. So I think it was easy for her to explain that she was just hooking up on TV for ratings.
She's one that we're going to be able to watch, like Trump's daughter, who came out really, really well. Agreed?
Ivanka is gorgeous.
Yeah, and she's got a brain and she's got a spirit and an attitude, too. I wonder if Madonna's kids are going to pop the same way.
Totally, and I think the father's really cool, too. You've seen some of his work. It's great.
What happened to Guy Ritchie? Where is he when we need him the most?
It's true. He's being a father figure quietly behind the scenes like somebody else should be.
I want two guns and smoking barrels and Snatch. Those are film titles, by the way, folks.
It's true, and quite a thing to raise the kids on.
I've been talking here to Jeffrey Slonim. He's an In-N-Out columnist for Gotham Magazine. Any advice for up-and-coming young starlets like our intern Sasha here, 21 years old?
Well, I would flee from celebrity parents, maybe. If that helps.
Jeffrey, have yourself an amazing Tony Soprano Monday. Thanks for calling.
Merci.
David Lee Roth, mornings. 92.3 Free FM.